So this morning I'm going to continue to talk about trusting heart-mind. This is my fourth talk on trusting heart-mind. And if you've got a program, it doesn't look like many of you did, but a few of you did, you'll see what I'm talking about today. What I'm talking about is, I'm about seven or eight lines in now, and this is Song San's prose poem. The Tao is perfect like vast space, with nothing lacking and nothing in excess. Indeed, it is due to our choosing to accept or reject that we do not see the true nature of things. Can you guys hear me? And if you can't, you know there are seats in here still. If you'd like to come in here, that's fine. Don't want to come in here? Come on in. Last time and the time before, I was talking about how this prose poem is a combination of the best in Taoist and Buddhist teaching come together. And the hero in Taoism is not the king of the West, nor the king of the North, nor the king of the East, nor the king of the South, but what king? Huh?
Chaos.
King Chaos. King Chaos lives comfortably in the way, comfortably in the Tao. King Chaos has gone into those areas of most resistance, of most fear. He's gone into them. He's seen into them. He's been there with them. He's moved through them. So that he sees chaos as very good news. Very good news. Simple, huh? Simple. The Taoists make it sound so simple. So simple. But we know it's not that easy. And it's not that simple when we're actually practicing. And because of fear, we continually delude ourselves. We continually delude ourselves because of fear. Because we continually misunderstand life. We misunderstand the world. We misunderstand who we are. We forget who we are. We are, what does Song San say? We are the nature of things. That's what we are. We are the nature of things. Period. Not but. Period. We are the nature of things. We are the nature of life. But because of our fear-based body, that sort of shields us, we think. We forget. So Song San is trying to help us wake up. Right? Just wake up. Giving up our fear-based existence. Is it possible? Give that up as the focal point of our lives? Is that possible? Sure, why not? Why not? That's what Buddhist practice is all about, isn't it? And as I was saying during practice period talk, whenever that was, Wednesday, we have two different kinds of food in our Zen practice. We have food we take out of the refrigerator or the freezer. First we put it in the refrigerator and the freezer and preserve it, and then we take it out when we need it. And that kind of food is important. We take it from a book, from a teacher. We find a book that really helps us and supports us in our meditation practice. We find some phrases and we think about them again and again as we need them, bring them back to our attention again and again. When we get discouraged, when we get fear-based, when we think, oh shit, regardless of what we're saying or shit about, we bring them back. We cultivate the best food in the refrigerator. We buy the best food at Lund's. Not at Lund's, at the Wedge. I'm showing my preferences, right? My biases. The most nutritious food. And then we take it out when we need it. And it helps us. And I see people one-to-one. Now I see people one-to-one every week on Sundays, because just about every week I'm here. And that's so I can help you preserve your food in the refrigerator and give you some tips for how to preserve it and how to take it out when you need it. Pretty simple. And we have rituals. We have rituals that help us come back to just being here. To just, these rituals that we preserve in the refrigerator are rituals of great beauty that connect us to something very large, to teachers that we never knew, and yet we do know them. We don't have to think about them. We know them when we do the ritual. We give ourselves to the ritual. We know them. But we don't know anything. That's the refrigerator stuff. That refrigerator stuff is very important. But to live in the Tao, we also have to cultivate the ground. We have to grow our own food. Most religion is received religion. Most religion, most Christianity is received Christianity. Most Buddhism is received Buddhism. But that's not what Sung San's central point is. That's not his central point. Something we receive from others, we put in a refrigerator. But this is about cultivating the ground. You yourself. I'm sorry that you have such clay soil. You've got it. I'm sorry that your soil is so rocky. You've got it. It's yours. Cultivate it. Take care of it. Be with it. And use your refrigerator food to sustain you when you get pissed at the rocks. When you get clogged up by the clay. Get your refrigerator food out. Get some nutrition. Put some chocolate in the refrigerator. Not too much, but enough to see you through that next, that nuts round with your clay soil. With your clay sitting. You're sitting that just sticks in the mud. The same old stuff coming up over and over again. How could anybody have such clay soil as you do? As we do. So when I came to Minnesota, I was a naive young man, and now I'm a naive old man. And as a naive young man, we went up to northern Minnesota to farm. And we had never grown anything. We had never grown anything. And we're from California, and we go up to northern Minnesota to farm? My father said to my sister, What's happened to your brother's IQ? He used to have a very high IQ. What has he been taking? The soil is so bad, clay in the North Shore. We had 40 acres of clay. And my friend said, well, we're supposed, maybe we should be potters instead. But this practice, this Zen practice, is really about cultivating our own food. Digging the soil, working the soil, composting the soil, watering the soil, gently removing the rocks in the soil and replacing them with organic material, mulching the soil so that when it gets cold in the winter, the soil still stays healthy, over and over and over again. Over and over and over again. So that we can move through fear-based existence. We just move right through it and see that it's self-created. I mean, how could it? Of course it's self-created. Who else could create it? Oh, my mama created it. Okay, mama, you and I created it together. Mama and I created it. Right? Still, we self-created it, she and I did together. So in Buddhist thought, in Buddhist practice, fear-based existence has three primary types of delusions. Because it's delusions that make us not want to go outside and grow our own food. We're scared to grow our own food. We'd much rather hang out by the refrigerator or the freezer or the microwave. It's so much simpler. Just 30 seconds, got your meal. That's not the meal that will really sustain you. Do you want to eat the food that will really sustain you, that comes from your heart? Do you want to? Your food, not some teacher's food or some book's food or some religion's food. Screw all those religions. They have nothing to do with it. This is cultivating your own food. Even if it's just one little sprout, it's yours. You did it. It came up out of that soil because you loved that soil. You gave yourself to that soil. You worked with that soil, even when you were pissing and moaning. You still did it. You still did it. Three types of delusions, which you guys know have been with me for a while. And even if you haven't been with me for a while and haven't learned the catechism, you still know. You know, there's lots of Buddhist catechism. You know. Sorry, but there's lots of it. It's just all food from the refrigerator. Catholic, Buddhist, Hindu, food from the refrigerator. That's cool. You need it. But get out of the kitchen after a while. Please. Get out of the tea room. Feed room out after a while. Please. If you want to have a life, if you really want to be alive. So the first type of delusion is scarcity. That's the delusion of scarcity. That we just don't have enough. That we just can't really do this. We can't really do this. We don't have enough friends. We don't have enough wisdom. We don't have enough peace of mind. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough. And so we grasp and cling. And then its counterpart is what? Delusion of threat. I feel threatened. I feel threatened by the fact that something or other, whatever it is, something or other. Marty didn't smile at me. Instead of smiling, he growled at me after I'd been so nice to him. And I feel threatened. So what do I do? Push him away. Push him away. Go to Susan and think, well, maybe she'll smile at me. Maybe I can hang out with her. Even though I'm supposed to treat my students equally, maybe she can meet my needs. Right? We do this. We're threatened by each other, threatened by the world, because we're afraid. Fear-based body. Fear-based body. And the third type is just the fear-based self. That's the third type of delusion. Just this fear-based self. That's all. And Buddha says, supposedly, delusion holds up the ridgepole of the house of grasping, hatred, and sorrow. Delusion holds up the house of grasping, hatred, and sorrow. And here's a quote from the Nikaya. After Buddha had his enlightenment experience, and this was encouragement he gave to his monks. He said, "The ridgepole is broken. The rafters are shattered. No more shall you build this house of sorrow. No more shall you build this house of sorrow." Is that possible? That we can put our energy into something else than just continuing to create this house of sorrow? This house of delusion and suffering and sadness and anger? Is it possible that we can take the ridgepole down? No. That's what the teachers say. Trusting heart, mind, believes them. Trusting heart, mind, believes them. And doesn't just believe, but does it. Does the practice over and over. Over and over. So, for Sangsan, what is delusion? It's nothing more than choosing to accept. It's nothing more than not than getting caught by accepting or rejecting. Nothing more. We get caught by rejecting. We coagulate a bunch of rejection, and that turns into a nice deluded self. We get caught by taking in those people who are nice to us and protecting them and wanting everybody else to stay away. And that creates a nice deluded sense of self, nice and solid. But it's not nice. You know it's not nice. We human beings know it's not nice. Because we don't see the nature of things. We don't see that the way is vast like space, continually in front of us, behind us, under us, over us. And so in Buddhist thought, there are three levels of delusion. The first level of delusion is inattention, right? Inattention. We're always talking about that. So there's research that was done about 10 years ago. Some of you guys have read about this research. It was done in NBA, some kind of NBA offshoot of an NBA tournament, but it was it was not a real term, MBA offshoot. And they had people, the research subjects or the subjects were counting every time the ball was passed. During 3 minutes, they were supposed to count every time the ball was passed. And you know, in the MBA, the ball gets passed fast, so they're counting. And there was a group of subjects, I think maybe about 20 subjects, and during the middle of the 3 minutes, a man in a gorilla suit came on the court. And the man in the gorilla suit danced around the court, and then went back into the audience. And so, you know about this study? And so what was the deal? The deal was that then the 50% of the people who were doing the counting didn't see the gorilla. And when they were shown the tape, the videotape, they were amazed that there was a gorilla there, right next to them, right around all the players. Pushing and pulling. We feel insecure. We feel unsafe. So we keep this fear body alive by pushing and pulling. And we don't even see. We're inattentive. We miss it. And then what happens? We get exhausted from pushing and pulling, and we just veg out. Oh, shit. We just veg out. And each of us have different ways of vegging out. And you each have your special way, and your way that you think is not okay, and the ways that are minimally acceptable. And then some ways that are pretty acceptable. You each evaluate. Or maybe you just give up sometimes and just say, screw it, and veg out all the time. Until you have to get up and go to work or something. That's life. That's the human condition. Nothing new. Am I saying anything new? I don't think so. So, we use refrigerated food from the freezer, to deal with this inattention, to help us regulate our behavior so we can be more attentive. Regulate our caffeine intake. The kind of caffeine high that we get doesn't really make us attentive, you know. It makes us able to, so we do more push-pulling faster. But is that really attentiveness? Is that really the openness, the spaciousness of the Tao that's always present? I don't think so. So some of you guys know that I love green tea. I have to stop drinking green tea at 5 o'clock every day. And I made a mistake 100 times before I finally, because we do it over and over again, don't we? Over and over. Finally, on the 99th time, I said, no more green tea after 5 o'clock. And then just the other day, I was thinking, oh, I would really like a cup of green tea with my dinner. So I had a cup of green tea with my dinner, and then I woke up at 1:30 a.m. We are weird, aren't we? We are weird. It takes us a long time to change our behaviors. But that's okay. We've got plenty of time. This isn't about time. You're too much in a hurry. This is about the Tao. It's always available. Always available. And we're inattentive in so many different ways. I drive to work a long time. It takes me to get home from work now because I work in St. Paul. I live here, but it takes longer every year. For 15 years, I've been driving in St. Paul. Now it takes much longer. Well, here's a chance. I can be unconscious or I can pay attention. And I can just space out on that whole 60 minutes if I want to very easily. But then I'm killing the Tao in a way. And I'm killing the Tao. Although the Tao doesn't die. But in a way, I'm still killing it. But it doesn't die, so don't worry. But I'm killing it in my heart, you know. I'm killing it in my heart when I do that, if I just space out the whole time. And then our meditation. Meditation is our central practice here, as you guys know. As Zen students, as Zen practitioners, that's the central thing we do in our meditation. So, and a lot of time we spend on the cushion, we're inattentive. So we need to use lots of food from the refrigerator to help us. lots of food from the refrigerator. We can just follow Dogen's instructions of just sitting, but it will be very hard. I think Dogen doesn't suggest much food from the refrigerator. I think we need food from the refrigerator. I think we need it. He lived in a very monastic situation where life was ritualized, where everything was set up. We don't live in that kind of situation. Our situation is the opposite in America in the 21st century. It's the opposite. So we need lots of support. What do we do with our body? How do we take care of our body in sitting? How do we deal with pain? Different ways of focusing, but focusing on our abdominal breathing, sometimes that can really help. Focusing on just our posture. And then our mind, doing things with our mind, repeating something to ourselves when our mind wanders off. Something, some gata, some mantra, some phrase that Thich Nhat Hanh said or Suzuki Roshi said, or maybe that you said, that helps you bring yourself back. Bring yourself back to attention. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if it's a Zen or what. Just do it. Whatever helps you bring yourself back so that you're not gone. I mean, what's the point of coming here and being gone the whole time? Jeez, life is short, isn't it? And when we've done that for a while and we have a pretty good concentration on our meditation, then we can turn to Dogen Shikantaza. Then we can turn to Dogen's bare attention. Because that's what for these Zen guys, it's just, there's no technique. It's just being, just sitting, facing the wall. But we need lots of food from the refrigerator ourselves. Unless you're more advanced than I am. But it's better not to get that advanced, I think. Because if you get that advanced, you think you've got it made. Be careful. And that's canned food. As soon as you think you've got it made, you're not even food from the refrigerator anymore. Just canned food. You know what I mean? So the first level is lack of attention, and once we really work on becoming more attentive, what do we see? We begin to see denial. We begin to see the ways that we're in denial. We're in denial a lot of our time, about a lot of things. But only when we become more attentive do we see that denial. Do we see it? We deny in families. Every family has their secret. We support that as human beings. We learned that from our mom and dad. So, but now we're mom and dads ourselves. Are we going to perpetuate that? Pass it on to our kids and our grandkids? And we see it. My mother started drinking just a little bit, started drinking more and more. And by the time she was coming to visit me here in Minnesota with my little grandkids, she seemed to me like she'd been drinking, but I never saw anything. Then one day I saw her suitcase opened in the room we were staying in. There was a whole fifth of something or other in there. I don't know if it was bourbon or gin. A whole fifth that she brought from California. Talk about secret drinking. And then I felt, oh, this is a secret. What shall I do? And I whispered it to my wife. And we didn't know what to do because this has been a family secret for a long time. So finally I confronted my mother. Finally we come out of denial and we have to confront ourselves or someone else. Or it's unhealthy. We can never be attentive if we practice this superficial attention and are in denial most of the time. A social level, we deny too. Culturally, we're in denial all the time. I've talked here before about my other job. For more than 20 years, I go to the legislature every year, and I advocate for service for people with mental illness, for people with depression, for people with bipolar disorders, for people with anxiety disorder, for people with schizophrenia. And you know, when I started going about 22 years ago, no one in the legislature knew anybody who had mental illness. They didn't know anyone, right? They didn't know depression. They didn't have it in their family. Well, 22 years later, everybody's talking about it. Everybody has it. Oh, yes, Ellen says to me, my brother, my sister, but these are the same legislators that were 22 years ago. What's happened? We're going through a cultural shift. We've denied this. We've denied these things. We've repressed them for hundreds and hundreds of years. In this last 20 years, we're going through, thank goodness, a cultural shift in which we're not in denial anymore. We're beginning to accept. We're beginning to acknowledge. And when we acknowledge and accept, then our attention broadens. Then we lighten up and settle down into this Tao, which is not a Tao at all, which is the groundless ground of everything. We just settle into it. Here's a quote from, here's a little story from Jack Kornfield I like about this. The story about a man who is driving down the highway when he hears a safety alert on the radio. Everyone driving north on Interstate 187 should use great caution. There is a car driving on the wrong side of the divided highway. The man glares through his windshield and mutters, there's not just one car driving the wrong way. There are hundreds of them. Right? That's what we do. Tell me you don't do that, and I'll say your practice is so advanced we're going to put you in a can. We'll can you and put you on the shelf. We'll preserve you. So my friend Sheridan, whom I practiced with for a long time, and that's not a real name, but why I'm using that name, I don't know. I like the name. And she's a woman, by the way. My friend Sheridan, whom I practiced with for a long time, after I'd been practicing with her for 3 or 4 or 5 years or something, we had a candid conversation. She decided to have a candid conversation with me. Sheridan had perfect zazen. She sat cross-legged, she was graceful, she didn't fumble around like some do. What else about her? Oh, she carried herself well. When she served in the meditation hall, you know, the way we were taught to serve and the way we should serve, and so she just carried herself well. And she never moved when she saw it. She never moved from she sat. So after about 3 or 4 or 5 years of sitting, I don't know, Sharon said to me, Tim, I want to tell you something. I said, okay, tell me something. She said, I'm a fraud. I said, what? She said, yeah, I'm a fraud. She said, I know it looks good. I know it all looks good. But I'm always chattering to myself. I'm always worrying about everything. It just looks good on the outside. Even Suzuki doesn't know. Even Suzuki promoted me. Told me I needed to become a priest. But you know, I'm a fraud. Inside, it's just always... So she'd been in denial. And she came out to me. Out of the closet to me. Well, it was about time for her to come out of the closet. We've been almost best friends for 3 years. But it takes a long time to come out of the closet. When the time is right, you'll come out. You'll come out. And it'll lighten you up. It'll lighten you up. You begin to get a sense of what the Tao is. It's pretty light. And yet it's totally grounded. Do you understand? Completely light and totally grounded. So, my friend Sheridan began putting new kinds of food in the refrigerator. I said, well, you should go talk to Suzuki Roshi. I said, don't you have Doksan with him? She said, yeah, but I never bring this up. Duh. Duh. I said, talk to him. So she got new ideas about how to put food in the refrigerator and how to preserve it and how to use it. So she began having shorter meditations, not the long ones. She used to like to sit in Tassajara way late in the night. You know, the best people sat way late in the night. best people, right? Zen is very competitive sometimes. Very competitive. And she learned to do yoga. Do yoga in between every sit. That helped her because it helped her get back to her body. Get back to her body. And then she began working in the garden at Tassajara. In those days, we just had rocks at Tassajara. We had clay. And see, I went from rocks at Tassajara to clay in Minnesota. Just rocks. But she could. That was a time she could calm her mind. She could steady her mind. She wasn't a fraud anymore. And she did the short sits, and then she started repeating different things to herself to help her. The Suki Roshi didn't tell her those, but she started doing it on her own. So that's good. That's good. And Sharon's doing well now. She left Zen and moved to Vipassana, but she's doing very well. Vipassana is very good at getting the right food into the refrigerator and helping you take it out. Zen is not so good at that. But we don't have to be Zen or Vipassana. Let's just be human. Let's just be human. And anger. Big denial about anger at Zen centers. All the Zen centers I've been in. We suppress anger and then we repress anger because we think Buddhists don't have anger. Well, okay, all right, let's just... I'm okay with you thinking that, but don't. Be careful about suppressing it or repressing it. It's part of your denial system. It's part of your fear body. It won't help. It won't help. And as we were saying the other night in practice period, if you do that with someone a little bit, if I keep repressing my anger at you, after a while, I am going to not want to be around you anymore. I just won't want to be around you. And I might even start to hate you. But if I just see the anger, if I just deal with the anger, it's not that big a deal. Hatred always is a result of either suppressed or repressed anger, I think. Maybe that's a generalization, but I think most times it is. Most times it is. And the denial thing that I work on, and that I have not mastered, probably never mastered, is need for downtime. I just can't seem to get that one. I cannot seem to get that one. You know, my health gets good, and then I'm just... And, you know, I'm just doing. Of course, including sitting. Including sitting. But I don't know. Why I think I'm a Superman, and then I crash. It's a silly idea. But we have lots of silly ideas, don't we? And that's fine. We can just laugh at them. But let's not get calcified by them. Let's not get caught by them so that we can't enjoy the spacious Tao. So lack of attention, denial, and then misperception of reality. Misperception of reality is this kind of the deepest level of delusion, the deepest level of sustaining the fear body. Happiness, the delusion in our misperception that we can get happiness from outside. We can't. We can't. We can't get it from money. We can't get it from achievement. We can't get it from being the best sitter. We can't get it from even a relationship. We don't get it from a relationship. It happens when there's not getting, but when we're trying to get it from the outside, we'll get a little bit, a little bit. You know, we can have some kind of a little, God, I finally did it. I finally got those legislators to give this money for homeless people. Well, that sustains me for 3 minutes or something. Oh, finally. The best orgasm you've ever had. That sustains you for 4 minutes or something. Right? Whatever it is. Right? That's not the happiness from growing your own food. You have a chance to grow your own food. You have a heart, and you have a mind, and you have a body. You can grow your own food. You can can find the happiness from just a little tiny plant that comes out of that earth. A little tiny plant that you mulched and watered and took the weeds out and every day attended to it. And then it sprouts in Minnesota. It sprouts in Minnesota in the red clay. There it is. There it is. So a study was done on paraplegics and quadriplegics, their happiness level before their accidents and their happiness level after their accidents. And what did they find? They found that out the 2 years after their accident, their happiness level was the same as it had been before their accident. 2 years. Studies of wealth and happiness. You know about studies of wealth and happiness, right? Studies of wealth and happiness say that there is no relation between wealth and happiness as long as you have enough nutritious food to eat. If you don't have enough nutritious food to eat, there is. There is no relationship. What are we doing in this country, you guys? What are we doing? And this permanence. Permanence is the other, is the second of the third of the deepest levels of delusion. This is all from, you know, the Buddhists are into counting stuff and all that stuff. Pre-literate culture, right? So the second one is permanence. Of course, we know everything is impermanent, so that one, I shouldn't have to say much about that. I won't say much about that. But even though I don't say much about it, it's hard. It's hard for me. Impermanence is hard for me. For about 40 years, I sat in half lotus. My first year of sitting, after 12 months, I finally was able to do half lotus. Wow, then I was one of the big boys. Well, one of the big boys. I don't know about the girls, but one of the big boys. And then last year, I hurt my back, and my chiropractor, and then I went to my chiropractor, and I keep going to my chiropractor, and I have numbness in my foot. My chiropractor finally said, well, you know, this numbness may never go away. So I may never sit half lotus again. Everything's changing. That's, you should say, you probably think, well, that's no big deal. Think of me. I know it's no big deal, but see, this is my self-image. I'm the Zen teacher around here. Well, that's it. That's the problem, isn't it? That's what we get caught by. That's what we solidify around. And when we solidify around that, we miss something. We miss something that's always present. And its very absence is present. So Jack Kornfield tells a story about a bunch of nomads in the desert riding their camels. Some of you know this one, I think. And they're riding along in the desert, and the dad is in front, and the kid is in the back, and the oldest son keeps saying something to the dad. As the dad turns around and talks to the son, they keep saying something. And finally the dad says to the kid, stop asking if we're almost there. We're nomads, for crying out loud. We're nomads, you guys. We're just here temporarily. Everything's changing. Our forms are changing. Our bodies are changing. Our needs are changing. We're just here for a short time. Can we be here? Really here for a short time? And just be on the camel. Just be on the camel. We ain't ever going to get there unless we come back here. That's the only way we're going to get there, is to come back here. Sorry. I'm not sorry at all. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And of course, our strongest misperception is that delusion that the fear-based self is real. That's all. And by planting seed after seed in this garden, which we really have been cultivating, don't plant the seeds without the cultivation. It won't work. Then we'll experience the joy of homegrown food, the joy of some lettuce coming up in the spring. Almost lettuce comes up very early if you plant it very early. Actually, you can plant it in the fall and it will come up in the spring if you've really taken care of your soil, if you've really, really composted and mulched. The lettuce comes up really early. And then the tomatoes, finally, maybe not till August. It depends on the summer, depends on the climate. And you taste those tomatoes. You taste those tomatoes you grew yourself, that you grew with your own sweat, your own love, your own interaction. Is there anything better? Is there anything better? Trusting heart mind. So here's a monk whom I suggest you all emulate. If you have to emulate anyone at all. In the time of the Buddha, there was once a very unclever monk who wanted to see the Buddha face to face, but the monks around the Buddha said, "If you can't see him, you're too stupid." The unclever monk said, "But I want to attain the fourth level of arhatship." The monk said, "Then you don't need to see the Buddha. We will help you." Friendly monks, right? Friendly Sangha, right? They told him to go sit in the corner facing the wall. Like the innocent idiot he was, he went and did what he was told. The monks threw a coconut at him, hitting him on the head. "Ow! What have you done?" "You have just attained the first level of arhatship," the monks replied. "Now go and sit in the second corner." When he did, they picked up another coconut and hit him on the head. "Ow! Just attained the second level of arhatship. Go and sit in the third corner now." Then they hit him with coconuts in the third and fourth corners. Afterward, the unclever monk ran to them, made three bows in front of them, and walked away as a Buddha. But those clever monks are still sitting there, wondering what happened, still trying, struggling, knowing full well that they are not there yet. Trusting heart mind. Trusting heart mind. So Achan says, "Delusion is like a village terrorized by bandits. When delusion is dispelled, bandits are gone, and the whole village goes about its business undisturbed." Undisturbed. All we have to do is stop accepting and rejecting, just for 1 minute. If you completely stop and accepting and rejecting, pushing and pulling, for just 1 minute, you'll see the true nature of things. You will. I promise. Trusting heart mind. I promise. It's not Tim's promise. It's the trusting heart mind's promise. William Carlos Williams, the poet. "So much depends on a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. The way is perfect, like vast space, with nothing lacking and nothing in excess." Okay? Okay? So, questions, comments?
Well, this is refrigerated food, but it's still interesting.
Okay.
There's a performance going on at the Southern Theater called The Wozzeck Project. And it's a recreation of the mind of the playwright of that play, which I'm actually not all that familiar with. And it's being performed by a bunch of great dancers and performance artists It's bizarre, no question about it. You move through the space, and people are doing all kinds of strange things. And you can watch. And it culminates down in front of a cage, which is actually about the size of the Zendo here. The cage is made out of a cyclone fence, and it goes up about 12 feet on four sides. And there are about as many people in that cage as there are right now in the Zendo here. It's bedlam. People are half clad. They're doing terrible things to each other. And of course, you don't actually realize what's going to happen when you first go down there. So I found myself standing about a foot away from the cyclone fence. And then people come, the performers come in, and all hell breaks loose. So it was, first of all, I found myself sitting there like this, with my arms crossed in front of me. And then I thought, well, let's see if I can just kind of relax and take this in. Not put my hands in my pockets. Just watch and see what comes up, because it's a performance, right? You know it's a performance. And yet, everything that is happening is so graphic that you can't help but have a reaction to it. And people go from running to the fence and climb up and fall back down again. And they're attacking each other and they're doing things like that. And at one point, somebody came over, one of the inmates, and he was kind of reaching through the cyclone fence, and I actually felt some compassion for these people. I mean, not as performers, but it's just a kind of a natural response that was just from what was there. So I kind of reached out, and I didn't move away. And at the end, so it kind of builds to a climax, and so there's somebody who's kind of crouched down in the corner there, and she's looking at me, and as the performance ends, she's saying, she's mouthing, "Good job, good job, good job." So, check it out. It's refrigerator food, but it's good.
Thank you. Yeah, Matt.
I just wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit. At the end there, you used the words accepting and rejecting.
Yeah.
And usually, we set up the polarity of grasping and rejecting. So did you use that word accepting intentionally as far as kind of like fake acceptance? Or is that, are you, where you were?
I did it for two reasons. One is I was trying to be respect the integrity of the text, and the text uses the term it's accepting. But the way the text uses it is certainly not the way Suzuki Roshi used it. It always uses it as the polar opposite from rejecting. So in a way, it's just what you say. It's this superficial acceptance that we do, and we just sort of give up. We just accept because we, you know, think we can't deal with things. I'll just be accepting. I'm supposed to be accepting anyway. I'm a Buddhist, you know. I'm going to be a priest, so I'll be accepting. Well, that's denial. That's not real acceptance. Does that make sense? Anybody else?
Almost like resignation.
Pardon?
Almost like resignation.
Yeah, resignation. Yeah, stoic resignation. Although the Stoics, actually, if you read them, they weren't stoical. Their acceptance was more like Suzuki Roshi's, if you really read the Stoics. But that's the modern connotation of Stoicism, resignation. Anybody else?
On the other side, not rejecting and not seeing excess, is there some discernment necessary if we feel we're being overfed?
If we feel like we're being overfed?
Yeah.
Well, of course, discernment is always important. Even when we learn to grow our own food, we still have to decide what food to put in the refrigerator, how to preserve it, when to use it, when to eat it. We always need to be discriminating. So to just chow down on all that food we produce in the garden overnight, then it's not being discriminating. Not being discriminating. So discrimination is part of this. But it's discrimination without being judgmental. And that's possible, to be discriminating without being judgmental. I know that sounds paradoxical, but I don't think it is. Does that make sense? Do you want me to elaborate more? Does that deal with your question or not?
It does. I'm also concerned, I guess, with the overabundance of canned food. And
in our right now?
Force fed and being maybe having somebody else try to solve someone's problems.
There's an overabundance of canned food. Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So we're concerned about that. So just to throw away all the canned food is not going to help. All of the canned food was, you know, they're dealing with some problem. It's dealing with some issue. It's dealing with against scarcity issues. So just let's help each other get in touch with that. Get in touch with that and move through it.
So can you elaborate on the discernment and judgment piece?
Well, I'm saying judgmental, because judgmental is that I'm judgmental, I'm pissing and moaning. Either pissing or moaning. Excuse, I don't mean to storm. I'm an American, right? I'm pissing or moaning. Judging, I'm just making a judgment, a clear judgment that I need to put this food in the refrigerator. I need to freeze these tomatoes. I need to can these. I've got the next few months. These I can eat raw. I'm judging. I'm not being judgmental. That's all I mean. Does that make sense? That's all I mean. Anything else?